right, great. I'm going to ask the panelists to run to this stage. No, really, like run. So we have one last panel that I hope you guys hang in there with us for, because I'm particularly excited about it, because not only do I get to moderate it, but I also had the pleasure of being able to select the panelists, and they're all people that I think are just incredibly brilliant and activating when it comes to talking about PrEP in the context of a more comprehensive sexual health, sex-positive dialogues. Thank you. Now, I do realize that I think those of you who attended the pre-con, you're actually on your ninth hour of conference material, so hang in there. We will try to stick to the original timeline, so I might make a little bit of adjustments from there. Is there an extra chair there? Yeah, there is, because I'm not going to stand here the whole time. Let me at least introduce y'all from here, and then I'll switch over. No, I'll move over there. It's fine. Okay, so I just wanted to give a little bit of introduction, and in the incredible theme of keeping people human, I am going to add a little bit of something you might not know about the individuals who are here to share with us sex-positive dialogue and comprehensive HIV prevention. And I'll start with Kenneth, who is sitting right, I'll start right here. So Kenneth Nuguri. And he is a senior lecturer and researcher at the Department of Public and Community Health at the Jomo Kenyatta University of Agriculture and Technology. I have the pleasure of working with Kenneth on a number of different projects, and it's great to actually be able to see him face-to-face, because we've talked on the phone for over a year, and this is the first time I've actually physically seen him. So thank you. The thing that Kenneth was willing to share about himself that's a little off the radar, perhaps, is that outside of his workspace, he enjoys lively debates on political issues. So I thought his time in the U.S. is very well spent. And he should not have difficulty finding that here. Next is Dazon Dixon. And Dazon is the president and CEO of Sister Love. And she's also the leader of the Women in PrEP, the U.S. Women in PrEP Working Group. And I've had the opportunity to interact with her often on that, and a real champion for bringing prevention to women, particularly in Atlanta, but worldwide. And the little piece that I think is great about Dazon that she was willing to share is that she says, "I take my silly very seriously. Laughter helps me learn." And I think I can really relate to that as well. Over next is Maureen. So this is Mo Connolly. She's a pediatrician with the Henry Ford Health System School-Based and Community Health Program and investigator with the Health Disparities Research Collaborative in Detroit. So she's out by me. And her practice philosophy includes bringing up Beyoncé in as many patient visits as possible. And finally, I'm not going to go through all of what Bob Remian, because we got to talk a bit about him this morning. But just to note that he really is a longtime advocate, clinician, and researcher. And he's going to be talking about his experiences as well in the epidemic and rolling out PrEP in New York. But the piece I find interesting about him is not only that he's a diehard native Yankees fan, but I just learned that he is also Mets curious. So the way in which we're going to do our panel is actually we decided not to have presentations. I'm going to ask a couple of questions just to kind of get the ball rolling, and different people will jump in and answer those questions. And then I'm going to be real anxious to switch it over to you in the audience so that we can really have a discussion. It will help to keep us all engaged. I realize we're the last block before we have some poster sessions. So while I'm asking my questions, I hope that you can think about some different questions that might be relevant or something interesting for you. I'd like to start with each of you actually answering this one, and it's just to please share something about your work in this area and experiences that have shaped your approach to PrEP. And anybody can jump right in.
I'll go first. I work in Detroit in a 14-site clinic network of school-based health clinics. So I'm a pediatrician, and our focus is really providing access to health and wellness for adolescents and young adults. And obviously a big part of that is sexual health and reproductive health, and the ability to have conversations about PrEP in places where young people already are is a big part of what we're hoping to do in Detroit. As some of you may or may not know, Detroit is a huge geographic swath of land. It's 139 square miles. You can fit Boston, San Francisco, and Manhattan inside of Detroit and still have room left over. So we have a huge geographic location with people spread really kind of far and wide, and so the idea that we're bringing these services to where young people are already is something that's a big priority for us as a program, but also as it relates to PrEP access. And so that's something that we're hoping to roll out across the city and really make it so that if you can get to your school, you can also get to PrEP.
So good afternoon. My name again is Kenneth Ngure. I work in Thika, which is about 50 kilometers north of Nairobi. I've been privileged to work in the Partners PrEP study, which started in 2008 up to 2011, ending actually 2012. And in this study, we all know that PrEP was shown to be efficacious among HIV serodiscordant couples. Beyond that is that we took PrEP a step further and had our first demonstration project, which is ending in June. Again, in the Partners Demonstration Project, we've been able to demonstrate near elimination of HIV transmission when PrEP is used to as a bridge to viral suppression among HIV serodiscordant couples. So that primarily is what I've been involved in. But now we have some innovative projects that are coming up. So clinical trial demonstration project. So we'll have another project that's going to do some pilot delivery for the HIV serodiscordant couples within public health settings, in real life settings. We're expanding beyond discordant couples to young women, and I'm happy Jessica is here because we're going to focus on young women aged 18 to 24, where we're going to support adherence through use of voice pill. And we're going to do that project in Thika and in Kisumu. So basically that has been our main work, but I'll be happy to take some questions.
Good afternoon. Wake it up. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Thank you. Just want to make sure we're all in here. All right. So I'm Dazon, and thank you so much, Reve, for bringing us together and for having a different kind of conversation this afternoon. Since I'm in this work because I love talking about sex, so this is the best panel of my day so far. And I can't believe how many people ran when we're getting ready to talk about sex. But it's all good. Maybe because they're looking for it on the beach. But anyway, no indictments. So I work with Sister Love. We're 27 years old come July. We're intentionally a sexual and reproductive justice organization with an HIV lens. We're also a community-based organization that's a direct service provider that intersects and integrates the advocacy on behalf of women's reproductive health and rights, sexual reproductive health and rights, and with the focus on prevention primarily, and also on leadership, advocacy, and agency. In my own story around how we come to this PrEP issue is because Sister Love is one of those few organizations that has developed our own interventions, that has made it through a community-based participatory research process, and our behavioral intervention, which is also about 27 years old, ended up in the Centers for Disease Control's Compendium for Prevention, Evidence-Based Interventions. And while it's behavioral, it is also adaptable to incorporate new news and new information. Alongside that, in terms of looking at women's access to prevention tools that we can control in our own hands without negotiating someone else for our prevention, without putting all of our trust into our partner for taking care of our prevention, we've been on the fighting front for microbicides for well over 20 years. And so the advent of engaging with the PrEP science as well as other biomedical prevention strategies that women and young people can control themselves has been extremely important. And so in addition to convening the U.S. Women and PrEP Working Group, over the last few years in the U.S., where we have been working specifically on PrEP, even though we have a program office in South Africa, we hadn't implemented it there yet. is we implement a suite of work called STARSHIP, Strategies for Those at Risk Seeking High Impact Prevention and or PrEP. And so in STARSHIP, we do a number of interventions, community education. We've also worked as a non-clinical community-based HIV testing and linkage to care provider to incorporate what we call testing and linkage to care for all, which fits right in with the heuristic that Jeremiah was sharing earlier in terms of how we determine which pathway you go. You get linked to something that keeps you inside a continuum regardless of your HIV outcome. And other interventions that we do, we've created a standard PrEP 101 for women that's accessible online that anybody can use as a basic community education tool, and a couple of other interventions that we're very, very excited about implementing for youth. One call, ready for it? Hashtag PrepFlixAndChill. which is the point of this conversation this afternoon. Where we sit in doing, whether it's PrepFlix or Chill or our new social media campaign to hear women's voices that we're calling I Desire, is that we're going to shift the next paradigm on this conversation in terms of whether it's in care, whether it's in prevention education, community mobilization, is that I want us to move away from working around sexual health as a disease avoidance practice and focus in on sexual well-being. And when you talk about, I think that Ken mentioned it, when you talk about wanting to talk with your providers about sex and why don't you, the question to ask is, why would I? What am I talking about and what's that for? Because if they just want to talk to me about my behaviors and what I need to avoid, I'm not interested in that. But if they're, you know, I really do want that Fitbit. How many orgasms am I short this week? so that I can make it to, you know, the happy ending by Sunday. So there's that kind of thinking that I also think needs to shift in our capacity to understand why folks are wanting to take PrEP or get engaged and maintain their adherence strategies. And it's not because they want to avoid a disease, it's because they really want to have great, healthy sex for as long as they possibly can. And just on a last note, I'll tell you what piqued me was, in South Africa, wherever you go, whether it's the Clicks or whether it's the Dis-Chem or whether it's the Pick and Pay, whether it's a grocery store or a pharmacy, when you pass by the section where there are condoms and lubes and all of that available, there's a big sign above it that says sexual well-being. Now, you may not even be looking for condoms, but if you're walking down the aisle looking for hand cream and something says sexual well-being, you're going to stop and look. And that's what I mean by us shifting the paradigm of how we're thinking about the prevention work that we're doing.
Good afternoon. I'm not Dezan, although at times I wish I were. We go way back. So my experience in PrEP is not highly focused. It's rather diverse. It's mainly through the clinical work that I do, direct clinical practice. I'd say mostly PrEP around with men who have sex with men, but also with serodiscordant couples that I've worked with for many, many, many years. And that's both heterosexual and gay male couples. And also, my experience that I'll be commenting on will come from my work with the New York State Governor's Task Force that you've heard about, and work with the New York City Department of Health that actually Ken just highlighted and showed some pictures of the work happening in the city and the state, and my involvement with that, as well as colleagues in our research center who are doing focused research on PrEP.
Thank you. I'm going to steal this a little bit.
Yeah.
Oh, yay. So as I hope you just were able to recognize, we really have a diversity of representation here. We have Bob that really works a lot with MSM in a city that I think many of us would consider to be fairly progressive in terms of their progress towards PrEP implementation and towards prevention of new infections. And then Mo works a lot with youth as well as transgendered youth in an area that is extremely urban but large and has very little, I can tell you just from being in Michigan, awareness around PrEP as well as prevention strategies, particularly for youth. And then you have Dezan working with women as well as other groups and trans women in Atlanta. Again, also around the world, but that's where the roots are. And then Kenneth talking about the work that he's been doing predominantly with couples, discordant couples in Kenya. And so when you think about all these different diverse populations that we're trying to consider dissemination of sex positive kind of messages, I was curious really for anybody to be able to speak to. You know, when you think about our panel's title is Sex Positive Dialogue and Comprehensive HIV Prevention, a Package Deal. And I think that for each of you, there's probably something that comes to mind in terms of things that should be optimized, given what your community standard of care is for that, and probably things that need to be avoided in order for us to be able to achieve each, sex-positive dialogues and comprehensive services. And Daison, you started to touch on some of those things, but I'm wondering if we could just spend a couple of minutes really in a concrete way helping the audience to think about what are some things maybe that are going on in systems of care here or in your particular area that you really want to pull back or try to pull away from because it's not overly sex-positive, and things you might want to add to make it more so.
So I think the first paradigm that I really hope to come from in Detroit is having these conversations in a primary care setting. I think siloing things into kind of STD clinics or, so I have a group of transgender youth that I take care of, making them go to an endocrinologist to get their care, I think is first off setting up just a huge limitation for their ability to access care. So really kind of co-locating all of the things that somebody needs to be a fully formed sexual being and also affirm their gender identity kind of in the same spot. So that's one thing. And then a mentor of mine kind of told me, especially when taking care of trans youth, it's like we're throwing a party every time we see them in clinic, right? Because you know, specifically with trans youth, we are helping them become their truest, most authentic selves. And I think that that work has actually informed how I deal with all young people, is that this is a party. Like, you're here, you're taking care of yourself, you know, this should feel good. This should feel positive. And I have to say that the feedback from that type of approach is really positive. Especially for young people who are trans or who are LGBTQ, really affirming the way that they're having sex as great and really saying that that is a beautiful way to be with someone. I mean, how, as a young person, for those of us in the queer community, how many times did you hear that from adults? And so I think just having that kind of real positivity, as you had mentioned, sets up an atmosphere where folks come back because it feels good to be celebrated in that way.
Yeah, I mean, the behavioral intervention, I'm with you on that one, Mo. The behavioral intervention, just to give you an example of a part of the challenges, because that's also some of the questions that we created, is called the Healthy Love Party. I mean, and it was Healthy Love Party was very intentional about asking, how is your love healthy? And that gives you a broader way of asking, not just about your sexual practices and risk behaviors, if you will, but also if there's violence involved, if you don't have a sense of power in the love relationships you have, how do you line up your love with your family versus your intimate partner, with yourself, with whatever your other belief systems might be. And when we started to go through the evaluation program as a part, in partnership with the Centers for Disease Control, go through the 6 months worth of working on the protocol, and it comes back, before it even goes through our IRB, it comes back saying, well, you can't even use the word party in your title. Well, we've been using that title for like 10, 12 years, but there's nothing that we want to associate with sex and prevention with partying or having fun. Really? So that's what we're setting out to prove, is that when you create an environment that you can have fun in, I want people to leave my workshop feeling hot and bothered and informed on how to be sexy. So, and that's what we used to create. And then when we had to formalize it in this public health system, what did you say about the malpractice thing? When we had to formalize it in this public health framework, it lost that sensitivity around the sensuality of what we were trying to talk about. We couldn't even use our box of erotic potential anymore, which basically had like fly swatters and honey and paintbrushes and things like that in it, masks. So that's just one example of what some of that challenge is. And then the other part, I think, is understanding, and I think Sharon Hillier says this all the time best, is that we have got to understand that women are not just men in smaller bodies, and that even how we engage what we value in our sexual relationships versus our sexual behaviors looks different, sounds different, feels different, smells different, but we don't create the different pathways to understand what that means. So when we're talking about why don't we have a greater PrEP uptake, it's because we're not addressing what risk looks like when you're in a continuous monogamous relationship and don't understand that the behaviors that you're actually engaging in with or without your knowledge are putting you at greater risk, because you're not talking to me about my relationship, you're talking about how I have sex. And that's not what I'm interested in talking about.
Just to add a HIV serodiscordant perspective, in terms of sex-positive dialogues, is when HIV serodiscordant couples get their initial diagnosis of discordance, the discussions change. They worry a lot about the risk of HIV transmission and acquisition. But coming to hear about PrEP, when we've done qualitative work with discordant couples, they say that PrEP comes to solve their discordance dilemma. So they are able now to resume normal lives. They may not say, they say normal lives, which means normal sexual lives, because there's PrEP. And they're able now to achieve even their fertility desires and many other aspects of their lives. When they're coming to the clinic, they're usually at a loss, don't know what next, because now we have a discordance diagnosis. But then when they are counseled and informed about PrEP, they actually take up PrEP very well.
So I'm going to steal from the End the Epidemic New York campaign for PrEP, because I love it. It's the idea, and I may not understand it right, but don't tell me, because I really like the way I understand it, which is to make sure that for a successful program, you really need to have access. You need to have, well, awareness, access, and affordability. And we just talked about how we're really representing very different communities here, and I was wondering if you might be able to speak to, just thinking about those three things, where's the greatest challenge in the communities in which you work right now?
I think a lot of good things are happening in New York, and we've heard about that, but that doesn't mean that it's all solved. And I guess for a moment I'll just take a psychological perspective. I think it's hard for people to have some of the discussions around PrEP and, you know, when it does and doesn't fit into my life and who brings it up and who are you having these conversations with. We've heard a lot from panels and from Ken and from other people and from Al Liu and about, you know, the challenges of having talk about sex and from a sex-positive way, as Dezan and we're all talking about. You know, when you think about public health, unfortunately, public health is very much about public disease. It's about avoidance of disease, as opposed to, you know, positive sexual health and just feeling good and pleasure and all of those things.
Exactly.
And I think just even to pick up on what I talked about this morning for people living with HIV and a little bit of as great as the drugs are and how life-saving they are, I think in general, you think about people with mental health problems, you think about people with diabetes, you think about people with hypertension, people often feel like, I should be able to fix this, deal with it without having to rely on a drug. Mm-hmm. I hear that people talk about who have trouble sleeping and like, no, I don't want to take a drug. I don't want to take a pill because I should be able to do this behaviorally. Depression, I should be able to get over it. So I'm just putting that out there as a general thing that it is about taking a drug. So I think the dialogue is sometimes challenging for people to think, is that really what I need to do? Is that what I want to do? And I think there's an evolution here that's happening, but the whole issue, the concept of seasons of risk is real, and I work mostly with MSM when it comes to PrEP, really figuring out what is my season of risk. And if I'm in a relationship now, and is this a serodiscordant relationship, but then what if that changes? What if I have more than one partner? Do I take it intermittently? And I think providers are not comfortable with those conversations. They're a little bit, if they're going to have the conversation, a little more straightforward, it's best if you just take it every day.
Yeah.
But people will make their choices. So I think there's an evolution happening. I think it's, but the conversations are difficult. Yeah.
I think when it comes to working with youth, access is the biggest issue, especially in a large city with a really poor public transportation system. Many of the young people that I work with actually know about PrEP. One of their friends is on it, or they've heard about it. But the real issue is, how do you get to a place where you can get it? And so our approach, at least in our program, has really been trying to go to where young people are already. We're excited to be collaborating with the Ruth Ellis Center in Detroit, which is an LGBTQ community center for young people who are homeless or at risk for homelessness. And they see about 500 young people a year, 40% of whom are already HIV positive. So there's a large number of folks who are at high risk because they are all friends and in the same network. And so I think that idea, that especially for young people who don't have access to cars, don't have access, at least in Detroit, to very good public transportation, getting to a place where they are already and having them leave that place with a bottle of pills. We have a pharmacy delivery program that delivers to all of the locations where we work, so people don't have to take a next step to get into a pharmacy, or especially for like an 18-year-old, getting to a pharmacy is like going to the moon sometimes. So I think that idea that where young people are already is a strategy that we're trying to use in Detroit to address that access issue.
So, Bob, I think that's such an important point that you just made, and so some of us have been struggling with that a lot. Now that's really a bad analogy. I'm not going to use the thing about being married and making people think that they thought of your idea first. But that is it. So, from a public health perspective, the community, my population of priority, doesn't have to know what my incentives are and what my own ultimate goal, which is to prevent disease. It's how we get them to agree that they want to prevent disease, and it might be in a different way. So that's kind of a different way of saying meet people where they are in order to meet my own agenda. And so thinking about that in a different kind of way. For example, people didn't want to take pills for erectile dysfunction either. Now they're running after all of those different things that are out there because of how it's messaged and marketed. And if you had a running direct-to-patient ad around PrEP, for example, that talked about how it's going to reduce your anxiety, you won't be afraid of your partner anymore, it's going to enhance your sexual, your quality of life, it's going to do all of these kinds of things, maybe somebody would run to it as opposed to the messaging that we use in that. So that would be one example that I wanted to give. Challenging with the access for us, Ken mentioned it a little bit. I think Jeremiah might have pointed it out a little bit. I'm one of those born and raised in Georgia from the Deep South, which is way more than a geographic distinction. So when we're talking about the economic challenges, when you're talking about not just not having the proper insurance coverage, Medicaid, non-Medicaid expansion in the United States just doesn't mean that people who aren't working and don't have the ability to pay for insurance can't get Medicaid. It means that unless you are a single mother, pregnant, or a person under the age of 18, you will not get public health coverage assistance. Point final. So when we're talking about young black men who have sex with men who are over the age of 17, they have nothing. And this is the very population that we're talking about, wanting to be sex positive, wanting to affirm their sexual identity and their activities, and then giving them no access. So our challenge is the Gold Dome, which is our state capital, and all of the players who wear red every day underneath, the dispassionate, disassociated, disaffected Department of Public Health that we have, that's responsible for implementing these programs, and the fact that we are also not just in the Bible Belt, but we're in the buckle of the belt. And so we have all of these challenges about how to identify difference, how to respect and include difference, and then how to make sure that everybody has equal access and has equity in the access that we provide. So those are just those bigger challenges, and then those conversations about sex fit somewhere in there.
So also in the Kenyan setting, delivery and access for different population will be set up in a way that different populations access PrEP. For example, for HIV discordant couples, it would be set up in a way that the HIV-infected person, as the partners they're accessing their ALT, it could be set up in a HIV clinic so that both the HIV-negative and HIV-positive access the prevention and the treatment in the same area. Then for young people, it's good to make it available in young people friendly spaces, whether it's young women. MSM, again, is a different population which would need access again in a different place. Same thing with sex workers. So access for different priority population will be set up with that in mind, with their unique needs, so that it's responsive. It's not only put there, but nobody goes to access it. So it's going to be important that it's set up in a way that is easier for these populations to access. Beyond that, it's also going should be set in a way that people are able to access it in a way whether it that overcomes the traditional barriers that we know, like we can learn from ALT delivery. Yesterday we had Ambassador talking about rather than coming every month and every 2 months, maybe people would access PrEP every 6 months. Mm. So how could we do to make PrEP accessible every 6 months? In the PrEP trials, HIV testing necessitated that people come for PrEP every month. In the demonstration project and the current recommendations, it's every 3 months. But we are thinking that it could even be stretched further to 6 months. So, but then what would we need to do in between the first month and 6 months? Could self-testing come and fill the gap? Could it make it easier for people to access overcoming the traditional barriers of lack of transport, for example, to visit the clinics? So those are all those that we need to have in the back of our mind as we're moving to the next stage of scale-up to make it easier for people to access. Let's do some pilot studies like we are doing. Already we've learned quite a lot in our demonstration project. For example, in our demonstration project in Kenya, we have a costing component, which we are going to provide data on costing. We have a self-testing component, where we have been able to see that couples accept and are able to do self-testing, HIV self-testing at home. So we tucked in self-testing in between the months of visit. So our next phase would be to stretch the 3 months to 6 months and see how that pans out in terms of adherence and whether that is able to affect adherence in any way. So access for each group will be very cognizant of the individual group needs so that then it's responsive and increases uptake and continuation.
Thank you, Kenneth. And actually, it's something you just said bears mentioning is that we need to be so tailored and targeted with the population we're working with, because with adults, certainly every 6 months, every 3 months, we're not as clear on what needs to happen with adolescents. And if it is co-combined with hormonal treatment, for example, is it something that people would value having more opportunity to talk about? And I love the idea of making that a question, mm-hmm. not like just assuming we know what the distribution patterns are or adopting it because of a historical structural limitation, but really ask the question of what really meets the needs of the communities that we're serving. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think is very interesting is that we talk a lot about really trying to reach people that they have PrEP access, and a lot of the people that I work with still don't have the pieces that they need to make really solid decisions around PrEP. So even just getting people through the door, perhaps interested in PrEP, often really offers the opportunities that Jeremiah's outline was really showing of, you know, maybe PrEP isn't for you, but maybe there's these other services that would be. Maybe the, you know, actually engaging in care for people who have typically not thus far engaged in care, right. It's an entry, and we can do it really well and maybe seize the opportunity, but we also have the opportunity to do it poorly, and that may have some lasting results as well. We have about 11 really, left, and I was hoping that we might be able to turn it over to the audience, because I can continue to ask questions, but are there questions that you have from any of the panelists? Yeah, Jessica, just stand up and talk. We could repeat the question.
There is a microphone.
Is that mobile?
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't mind, I'm going to repeat the question. I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, but kind of talking about the notion of sex positive and the concept of sex positive discussions and how that would translate with the young women, for example, that Kenneth is working with in Kenya.
So thank you. I think if I got your question right, is then in the context of African context, the issue of sex positive among young women is to... to see PrEP coming in to sort of encourage and have women and enjoy sex without having to be so worried about HIV, the risk of HIV acquisition. So PrEP comes in to fill a gap of the HIV risk, and then so that then moves on to reducing that that worry about HIV risk.
Can I counter that just a little bit, just because I want us to distinguish the external influences on women, young women. Let's be clear, the population that we're talking about, and I'm thinking somewhere between 13, 15 to 24, 25. If you have parents and health providers from the community that they know, adults that they know, that's going to be a very different conversation than some of the conversations we've had in very closed spaces that we can laugh, we can talk about vaginas, we can talk about pleasure, we can talk about wet sex versus dry sex, we can talk about what kind of guys or girls they like. I mean, there are so many different ways that we can talk about it that isn't that different because of the age group and what they want to express versus what they're allowed to express when it's in external, in open spaces where there's a lot of structural and traditional ideologies and practices that squash that, that basically limit their own capacity to dream about their own sexual expression and sexual pleasure. I think what Kenneth is talking about is similar to what I've learned and read through, you know, if you know Damon Jacobs' amazing Facebook page, Prep Facts, Rethinking HIV Prevention, where so many, and it's because in the U.S. you're primarily talking about men who have sex with men, who are openly expressing the role that PrEP has played in reducing all of those anxieties and increasing their opportunity for pleasure and intimacy in their relationships differently than before they had the option of PrEP. And that's because when you look in a particular population, for them it's somewhat generalized. You can talk with young Black gay men who automatically, and trans women as well, young Black trans women who, just like my brother is a heterosexual Black man who didn't think he was going to make it past the age of 25. That's a generalized concept for inner city young Black men. I know young Black gay men who think they're going to get HIV before they're 35, period. And anybody they come in contact with, they probably are already positive. That's the way some young women are thinking, especially if they're older men who are their partners, that they're thinking they're already going to get HIV. So I think we have to be willing to take those risks and have those conversations, or even put them in a room by themselves and say, here's some questions. We're going to throw them on the floor. Y'all talk about this stuff. Somebody can take notes or record it, and we promise we won't display it anywhere, share it anywhere. And let's see what the true conversation actually is, because I think we put our own biases on top of it.
Ben.
Yeah, so great discussion. I have two comments and two questions that I'll just throw out, and then I'll sit down. First off, I actually just wanted to remark on how cool I love this community of people, and reflect that just a few months ago, a gay white American man, a middle-aged heterosexual Chinese American guy, and an African Kenyan sat down and broke bread in Nairobi, and so. Was just cool, because I like it's cool to be around friends. Comment number two is days on. I love you.
Love you back.
All right. Now to the more serious stuff, the work side of things. So one question is really more aimed at Kenneth, because Kenneth, you spoke a lot about implementation and facilitation and barriers to thinking about PrEP in the context of heterosexual couples in the African context. I actually wanted to just table, especially for you, from that African perspective, because we're so sort of American-dominated here, but also allow other panels to comment on it. So what about the non-coupled What about the non-heterosexual individual? And Dazon, I'm sure you've got a few words to say about this too. It would be unusual if you didn't, but I'd welcome the commentary either way. But really, it's about, from the African perspective, particularly since today, I just saw my Twitter feed that South Africa just announced that PrEP rollout will happen next month.
Yes.
So please comment on that. And then secondly, was to really amplify a little bit about what Rive mentioned, which is the idea of using the conversation about PrEP as an entry point into sexual health, other health components. And I just wanted to say the word, and then again allow you to amplify on this. I mean, we talk about HIV prevention in the sexual health context. I've heard the words syphilis and gonorrhea and chlamydia, but I've not yet, at least, and I've skipped out a lot, quite a bit, because of other things, but I haven't heard the word HPV.
Right.
And I just wanted to float for your consideration. Maybe we should be thinking about HPV vaccination, minimally, as part of this. Mm-hmm. And Jeff Schouten's here, who runs the HPV, you know, the anoscopy programs for Seattle. I mean, my God, we should be thinking about, you know, should this be the entry point for other really, really important and arguably deadly sexually transmitted infections where we actually have a preventative vaccination?
Lots of reactions.
Yeah, so thank you. For the non-coupled population, so the National HIV Control Program has identified key populations or populations at higher risk of HIV within our country, and they have been prioritized with the interventions, which include PrEP. PrEP has been recommended for those populations. So, for example, there is an ongoing demonstration project for sex workers and young women, and we'll have more demonstration projects. The beauty of having these demonstration projects, which we are learning a lot from how to target the different populations who are non-coupled, where to deliver it to, from. So we within those demonstration projects, we build in qualitative components where we try to learn from the population how they would want PrEP delivered, whether it's a standalone, whether it's in a public health facility, whether it's in specific organizations that deal with those with the different populations. So there's a lot of work that's ongoing, and PrEP, serodiscordant couple is among the populations to be prioritized, but also all these other populations, including young women in high endemic regions or counties, are also being targeted by different programs as a way of pilot delivery and learning from that in all aspects.
In regards to the HPV question, so I'm a pediatrician. Vaccines are bread and butter for what we do. And I think that really speaks to the value of placing these services into a primary care context. The idea that we're not only addressing whether or not PrEP would be a good tool for you. Are your vaccines up to date? You know, where are you? Let's talk about healthy weight. Let's talk about exercise. I mean, I just think really viewing this as part of the wellness package is really important. And so, yes, HPV is incredibly important. We're getting, you know, our grant funding and our program is dependent on how many kids we vaccinate for HPV at this point. And just having a conversation, again, as part of a sex-positive conversation about what HPV is and why it's something that we should be thinking about. So that's why it feels like primary care is such a great avenue to have these conversations, because you're really not leaving those things out, as they are equally important to people's wellness.
Thank you. Catherine Hansen's from New York. First, thank you so much for raising the issue of HPV and STIs, and it always makes me crazy that we continue to talk about HIV in isolation from other STIs. Number two, I also love Dazon.
Love you back.
Number three, drinks later. And then three, it's sort of a commenty question, and it's for all of you, I guess, up there, and you'll get when the question part comes in. But one of the things that also has frustrated me for many, many years is the reference to individuals' discomfort with certain talking to physicians about certain things, and then a response is that we have to tell the community not to be so scared. I don't know how we get to sex positivity when there is so much sex ignorance in the healthcare profession, And I'm, and I have also been in and out, probably for, anyway, I've also been in and out, so I may have missed this, but roughly 40% of the medical schools in the United States do not do sexual health training for their physicians. So how the hell are you going to get to be sex positive? And I, you know, I've found this, it's still going on in major universities where I've had the, you know, benefit or privilege or whatever, being invited to come hang out. I don't understand why there isn't a massive movement by all the physician organizations and institutions here to require that basic sexual health literacy training as part of a physician curricula. That to me is such a no-brainer. And then I guess the other, I guess, why isn't that happening? Why hasn't that happened? That's sort of part of the question. Ding. And then I guess the other part is, and I guess it's related, if you're not comfortable talking about anuses and vaginas, and Dazan and I were talking vagina and anus just the other day. And I don't actually, when people are interviewed about what kind of sex you have, I'm not totally confident in the accuracy of only a third of gay men saying, yes, I'm a bottom, I have butt sex. I'm not, because it depends on who's asking the question. But let's assume it's only half of all gay men. So are we defining risk for people? Are we, if we are not comfortable talking about butt sex as opposed to blowjobs, which is, if we all stuck to blowjobs, there would be no epidemic. Are we alleviating that concern about risk by telling folks, you only like blowjobs, you're never going to get infected. Stop worrying. You don't need PrEP. If that's what you do, you're pretty much okay. So I guess that's a cry for help, but also like a question about the training of physicians and how that gets incorporated into, how that sexual health literacy gets incorporated into PrEP access.
Hi, Liz. Actually, her question was a great lead-in for mine. I'm Liz Lowenthal from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and I do a lot of my work in sub-Saharan Africa with young people. And one of the things I struggle with mightily is talking with fellow health professionals in Africa about how do you talk with young people about their sexual health. And the most common answer is, no, culturally we don't do that. We don't talk with young people about sex here. And that's not even taking into account sexual minority youth whose voices really are stifled in those settings. So my question is if you have any advice about how to talk with colleagues in African settings about how to talk with their patients about sex, especially the young ones.
Yes. So there is a cultural issue. So maybe for those of you who have worked in Africa and have interacted with the case report forms, you'll notice that we don't use the word sex. When you have to, so it comes in English as sex, but then we use different words to say, like body-to-body contact. So the sex is open discussions about sex are not easy, do not easily happen. And especially now, coming back to Jessica's question, when among young women, it's even more difficult to have those conversations. But you'd be surprised, because we are having a cohort of 400 young women aged 16 to 20 within our site. And once we have an empowered provider, like one of our providers is empowered and is actually a man who is in his close to 50, is able to talk to these young women about sex, takes them into a room, because it's an observational cohort, but takes them into a room, talks to them about this, and they're able to open up, talk about the challenges they are facing, and you'll be surprised. So I think one of the key issues, we have a cultural issue, but if our providers are comfortable with the issue of positive sex, talking to young people, talking to others about sex, then it's easier for them to open up. There's also another cultural barrier, where then the young women or young men, especially young women, are not supposed to talk about sex, are not supposed to have sex. So then for many providers who are my age may look, or older, may look like their parents. So then already that creates another barrier. For talking about positive sex, their contraceptive needs, their reproductive health needs. So all those are specific needs that act as a barrier. So it's important as we think about sex-positive dialogues with young women to work on the provider. Once we work on the provider, the young people are ready to open. If they go and find a provider who is comfortable. We're also talking about having conversations about even contraceptive use. And we went to a facility within our setting to talk about contraceptive use. And when we talked to the providers there that, do you get 16-year-olds coming for contraceptive use? Even before they answered, the face would tell you if a young person came, they'd be scared to come back to that because they're not supposed in course to talk about sex or have sex. Yeah. And as in closing, also the parents, it's also a big issue. So when we are talking about young people in this cohort of ours where we have those 400 young women, if they are 16 and 17, they require parental permission. So they come with their parents. And when we are teaching the young women about anatomy, to know about their vagina, to know about their basic anatomy, the mothers also ask, what about us? We want to know, we have brochures. They also want to attend a session with the provider. So we also end up getting a session with them. So even the parents, as we are thinking about providers, also parents also need to know about these things. Because then the young women are left maybe to go to the boys to ask them for advice.
Exactly. Yeah. Ditto.
How about that?
No, I'm just, no, kidding. 60 seconds. Three quick things. One, you could do an entire dissertation and training for providers and community, and I'm not trying to steal your thunder, but we're in the same page, on just using Beyonce lyrics and titles. I'm not kidding you. Yes. I could do a whole conversation on prep and the ring studies just talking Beyonce. The second thing is, for those of you who are Americans and understand the agricultural communities, I grew up as a 4-H'er. People remember 4-H? The 4-H club. I was a member of the 4-H club, which meant, you know, you focused in on agricultural stuff. 4-H's is head, hand, heart, and health. I've been switched a little bit of that to focus in on our 4-H's for women, in particular, and young women, HIV, HPV, HCV, and HSV. Because the future implications of biomedical prevention, specifically around HIV, have ongoing implications for STIs, for contraception, for a whole lot of other things engaging our sexual health that we're not currently talking about when we're talking about HIV prevention. And then the last thing that I would say, especially when folks bring culture up, is I want to walk backwards for them and say, you know, there was a time when your culture used to say this, and now we do that. So if you can ever spend some time figuring out when the culture no longer serves you, then that's when you start to change the culture, because culture can change. You used to drum to communicate, and now you walk with one of these. There are different things. You used to push people's parts of their bodies, and now you use x-ray machines. There's all kinds of ways that we've changed practice based on changing culture, and so we can no longer use that as an excuse.
In closing, two things. The first related to medical training, which I'm actually pretty close to in my life. Doctors, by and large, apart from folks in this room, are pretty boring people. Like, the medical training system requires you to give up so many things, et cetera, and it's, you know, totally integrated with systems of structural racism in our country, systems of homophobia, systems of socioeconomic issues. So the idea that we're going to have a medical training system that has those structures totally embedded in it and then produce people that are able to talk about these things openly and recognize the way in which structural racism affects their patients, I think that's foolish, right? So, you know, it is what it is right now. Certainly those of us in the medical community need to work to change that. But I think the second piece is that collaboration with people in the community, having centering their voices in our conversations, I think, is incredibly important because, the medical training system is not one that's going to produce folks who are able to have these conversations, again, apart from folks in the room currently. The last piece is that when we're talking about positivity, I'm pretty new to this game. I haven't been to a lot of these conferences. And I think if you were to come to these conferences, you would walk away thinking very specific things about young black MSM. We just hear that so much. It's all young black MSM and HIV risk. And I'm just blown away by how much we hear that. And as you had mentioned, if that's the world and the healthcare system that you're operating in as a young person, it's hard to find feelings of hope and feelings of value in conversations that are continuously saying that you're going to get HIV. So that's again, right. Mostly because I'm new, I just like to say that reframing that as much as possible, especially in clinical encounters, I think is incredibly important, and really focusing on the positivity of being a member of this group, which is a wonderful and beautiful thing. And they choreograph all of Beyonce's dances, and they've just contributed so many wonderful things to our culture. So thank you.
I have nothing brilliant to add, except I couldn't agree with you more, Catherine. I think we all agree. I said earlier I'm a very optimistic person. The one place I remain pessimistic is changing medical schools and medical practice.
Yeah.
So except for examples and models and changing by modeling, and I would close by throwing it back to an organization like IAPAC, mm-hmm. International Association of Providers in AIDS, but in care. And maybe there's an advocacy or there's something that an organization like that can do, because it's hard. It's
hard to change. It is hard.
That tag would then protest around.
Yes.
In order for that to work. You guys, we've kept you a long time. I hope that we have given you plenty to think about in your conversations tonight. Lots to do, lots of advocacy to be had, lots of research. For us to be able to really push this dial forward. Thank you to the panelists. Amazing representation from such diverse communities. Thank you. The poster session has begun, or has been beginning in a couple minutes. Thank you so much.